there, fellow adventurers. I am Jason Conforto.
And I'm Tyler Crump, and we are hosts of a podcast, Adventure AI, where we play Dungeons & Dragons with an AI named Alex the Language Lord.
I'm Alex the Language Lord. Join us as we craft epic tales together.
Do you want to learn how to use AI in your D&D campaign?
Or how AI can force you to do things that you don't want to do? Wait a second, we don't like that.
Look no further. Adventure AI is the podcast for all your AI-powered D&D adventures.
Alex the Language Lord not only comes up with campaigns for us,
he also helps us create our characters, create our backstories, and even give us some fun magical items.
And really takes all of the human aspects out of Dungeons & Dragons. So it's not really playing at all.
Follow Adventure AI on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.
All right, welcome to another episode of Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole. I'm Jason Conforto, and I'm joined today, obviously, with Brandon Mole, and we have Christopher Paolini with us. Christopher, welcome.
It's a pleasure for you to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. This is also our first video episode we've done. We've been all podcast or audio podcasts for 2.5 years now, and so we're excited. When you've got a face like Christopher's, you got to throw it on camera, right?
You want to scare the audience.
Exactly. Well, thanks again for being here today. I think what we want to do is just start out just kind of learning a little bit more about you. I know your book series is huge and people know about that, but why don't we talk a little bit about getting started? And I know you're kind of the poster child for getting published young. So tell us a little bit about that experience. I'm sure this is a story you've told a thousand times, but we'd love to kind of hear how you got started and how unusual that was to get published at such a young age.
Sure. I'm always trying to figure out how to tell the story in a new and interesting way, because I have repeated this so many times. It's one of those things when you do public events for as long as I have, and Brandon, I'm sure you feel the same way, you get a certain repertoire of stories, and it's almost like, oh, I'm going to tell number three now. I'm going to tell number four. And then your brain just shuts off and you go into autopilot.
And Christopher, so if you have the standard patter, you can go into that and then we'll ask some questions that will hopefully take you into some new space.
The problem is that standard patter leads to a 40-minute presentation.
Oh, right.
So I'm going to try to make this...
Ready for us too?
Yeah, well... I'm going to try to make this a little more
conversational,
a little more casual, a little more conversational. Exactly. Okay, so where to start here? I guess I am going to go into a little bit of the standard pattern. So I grew up in Montana. I am in Montana right now. Brandon has actually, we've done an event together in Bozeman, Montana, which is about an hour drive from my home. So I live in Paradise Valley, Montana, which is gorgeous. And I was homeschooled my whole life because my mom is a trained Montessori teacher. So when my sister and I were born, her natural inclination was to start teaching us. And by the time we were ready for first grade, we were already a couple of grades ahead. So my parents decided it was a good idea to keep on that path. As a result, I graduated from high school early. We never really took any summer breaks. And I graduated at 15, all the way back in the 90s. And back in the 90s, we really didn't have any internet. It was all dial-up modem, and social media didn't exist. YouTube didn't exist. Google didn't exist. The internet just really wasn't what it is now. And
all we had was Dungeons & Dragons manuals.
You had that. I didn't even have that because I lived in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah, keep going. Sorry.
No, it's true. I mean, the nearest town from where we lived was a 30-minute drive, and I didn't drive. We didn't even get television reception where we lived because we lived down in the bottom of the valley, so the reception wasn't there. So for someone who's younger, I'd say try to imagine you don't have internet, you don't have television. You have radio, but that just gets you NPR, so you can listen to smooth jazz and occasional news updates from the BBC.
Right.
And the nearest neighbor is a half mile away, and they're in their 50s and run a construction company, so there's no one to play with. My first thought when I graduated...
What you needed was to find a dragon egg. That's what you needed.
That's exactly right. And that's what I wanted. Well, I mean, my first thought when I finished school was that this was going to be wonderful. I didn't have to do this thing I'd had to do every day for so long. Life was going to be perfect. And I had a lot of fun just running around and playing in my yard and digging holes and climbing trees. But then after about 2 weeks, I just got severely bored. And it's true what they say that, you know, boredom is the key to so much of creativity. And because of that boredom, I decided to try and write the sort of things that I enjoyed reading. And I had been and have been a huge reader. I'd read, we have these old Carnegie libraries. Carnegie libraries here in Montana. And I had read pretty much all of the sci-fi fantasy in our library. And not being the smartest kid at the time, I kind of felt like I had read all the sci-fi fantasy in the world, you know, that was all that there was. So I figured I was going to need to have to write the sort of thing I wanted to read. And what I wanted to read was an adventure story about a boy finding a dragon egg and going off on a big adventure. And I was specifically inspired by a great book called Jeremy Thatcher, Dragon Hatcher by Bruce Coville, which is part of his... it's part of a series that I'm forgetting the name of, but he's a fantastic author. And the funny thing is the book that I checked out and that I read, because Jeremy Thatcher, Dragon Hatcher is set in the real world, and it's about a boy who goes into this old antique shop and he ends up buying a stone that turns out to be a dragon egg. And a couple of years ago, like 2-3 years ago, our local library was having one of their sales where they're, you know, selling old books and selling books that don't get checked out and stuff for the community. And my wife was there and she saw Jeremy Thatcher, Dragon Hatcher. She picked up and said, "Oh, I remember you talking about this." She bought it without telling me and brought it home and showed it to me. It was the same book that inspired Aragorn.
Oh,
and
funny.
It still had the same card in the front of the book. And I can see on it the date when I checked that book out. I think it was like 1996.
Yeah.
And
that
I actually just
awesome.
Yeah, I actually just read Jeremy Thatcher to my kids for the first time and they really really enjoyed it, so that was special. So, anyway, long story short, I tried writing before Aragorn and I never got past the first 5 or 6 pages of a story because all I would ever have was the initial scene or incident, but I didn't really have the rest of the story. My parents noticed that I was interested in writing, and books on writing began to magically appear in the house. And some of the ones that were really useful for me, I have all of my nonfiction books over here. There was a series of anthology books, nonfiction anthology books put out by Writer's Digest back in the 90s and early 2000s called The Writer's Handbook. And these were essays by published authors in various genres about all different aspects of writing and publishing. And you can still find these out and about. So we had the Writer's Handbook from 88, 98, 2001. And one of the things that I learned from reading those was that, well, you have to write a couple of books before you can publish one, because you're going to write a bad book, a bad book, a bad book, and then you'll learn enough you can publish a book. And then the book that was really helpful for me was, let's see, I think it's behind a box here. One second. This was Story by Robert McKee. Now, this is a book for screenwriters, but it's all about the structure of story. And while I wouldn't recommend someone does everything in this book, what was helpful for me with this was... just sort of the idea that there was a structure to a story and that you could understand that structure and that that would give you a safety net for writing something that was 300-500 pages. So I'm almost to the end of my...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, after you.
Yeah, I was just saying, so you're like 5 pages in, you can't get past that, and you, part of that was not understanding the whole story structure up to that point.
Sure.
And so this is what it was able to launch you into finishing a book or...
Yeah, so what happened was I when I decided to try and write after I finished getting bored with digging holes and stuff, I tried writing a couple of stories. And again, it was like 5-6 pages and I just stall out. It's like, where do I go from here?
Yeah.
So I actually stopped writing and concentrated on reading these books that were in the house. And I didn't write anything for half a year, three quarters of a year while I was reading this stuff.
And then, how old were you at this time?
So I graduated at 15, And it was that year when I was reading these books. Yeah. So this would have been back in 1998 or so. And then, because I've always been very methodical, and this comes from the Montessori method that I was brought up with. So once I had this idea of, okay, plotting is useful, I decided, and I did, I created an entire fantasy world. I plotted a whole story about this princess named Arya, and it was a very family-oriented story. Her mother was an evil queen, and there was, you know, anyway, so I plotted out this whole story, created this whole world, and then I stuck it all in a drawer, and I've never done anything with it since. Then I said, well, now I know how to plot a story. Now I'm going to plot out a trilogy, because all great fantasy stories are trilogies. And I'm going to write the first book as a practice novel, and then I'll go write a real book. So again, I spent about 3 months or so creating this world and creating the story of the trilogy, and then outlining the trilogy, and then outlining the first book in fairly granular detail. And then I went and I wrote the first draft. And that was, that practice book was Aragon. But I will say, for any young person watching this, when I read that first draft, it was pretty awful. Now, I mean, I was excited to read it, but it was pretty awful.
And you recognized at like 15, 16 years old that it wasn't good. Is that?
Yes. And I think that's, if anyone's watching this, you want to write and you write something, and then you read it and you'd feel bad about it, like it doesn't match the quality of what you're reading in published books, that's a good thing. That means you have taste. That means you have judgment. You may not know how to bridge that gap yet, but at least you know what you're shooting for. And that's then I was very lucky. My parents are, you know, they weren't, you know, editors or published authors and professionally, but they're good readers, and that's what you need in a good editor. So they read the manuscript, they liked what I had, but they saw it needed a lot of work, and they provided a lot of feedback. That was actually after, so I did my first draft, then I rewrote it and gave it to my parents, and they looked at the second draft, and then they did their editing, and we spent almost a year editing and then doing the layout and getting it ready for self-publishing before we actually printed books and put it out in the world.
So you did the self-publishing route then for...
We did. We didn't know anyone in the publishing world. My parents had self-published two or three small things previously, because my mom was trying to write some educational books and trying to get those out in the world. And we sold maybe, I mean, under 100 books before I gave my parents the manuscript for Aragon. That's been something that people have criticized me in the past, like, oh, he was a Nepo baby. His parents were in publishing. No, we were at a 90-year-old farmhouse in the middle of Montana using print on demand and doing all the work ourselves. So, we decided to self-publish. And part of it was also because we knew the odds of getting published were low with a traditional publisher. And we knew, because of the writing handbook books, we knew the stats were pretty grim as far as the size of an advance you were likely to get, your chances of earning out your advance. Back when I started, I mean, the average advance was under $10,000, which it may still be, and something like 70 to 80% of all books never earned out their advance. My parents were always and always have been self-employed, and were always looking for projects that they could work on together and that we could work on together as a family. So when I gave them Aragon, it was a perfect opportunity for making it part of a family business. And that's why we decided to self-publish.
That's awesome. Let's go back just a little bit. You talked about reading the book, not liking it, but not being satisfied with it. How frustrating was that for you to know you had this amazing story in your head and you couldn't put it out on paper the way you wanted it to come across?
I mean, I'm still frustrated about that.
Yeah.
To this day with my current books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I live in the same place, Christopher. I had the exact same experience with everything I've ever written. And especially when I was a young writer, it would just drive me crazy because what I could see in my head was so much cooler than what I was able to communicate. And I have felt like ever since I'm trying to catch up to a place where I can sort of communicate the cool stuff I can see in my mind.
How much better do you feel that you're at, how much better do you think you are at it now than when you started?
so much better. Like if you saw me when I started, I would have never been at a professional writer if I had stayed at that level. I wasn't, like, if you looked at my first stuff, you wouldn't have been like, oh, this kid's got something. You'd have been like, oh, okay, like, this kid will, you know, he'll do something else, you know? But, like, the thing that I had was my imagination was awesome. I could see really cool stuff in my head. And so I knew that. So I had faith that if I could ever get my writing skills to catch up to that, maybe I'd have a shot, you know? Mm-hmm. But it felt like a long slog to get my writing skills to catch up. And I'm still fighting that fight. Every book I write, there's both relief that I'm getting a little better at it just gradually as I keep trying. And there's also a gap that I'm very aware of between the cool story in my mind and how much of it I'm able to deliver in a way that a reader could make sense of, you know?
Yeah. You know, and I think too that, you know, there's this whole thing, like, how teachable is writing? I mean, nonfiction writing is teachable. That's not a problem because you're just conveying information. But even then with nonfiction, how you convey nonfiction information is usually still structured in story format. A causes B, yeah. B which results in C. That's a story. Yeah. For me, and I think for a lot of people, and it sounds like it was similar for you, Brandon, is that you have to feel something. Like when I was, this is hard to put into words, but you know, I would imagine something, like you just said, I'd picture something and I would feel it. And mm-hmm. that was my driving force. That was my North Star. It was like everything else in the story, everything else with the technique was to support that, those images, those feelings, and then figuring out how to convey them and invoke them in the audience.
Christopher, and the thing is, like, I could describe it like this. What I see in my mind is like an ink blot. It's like a cloud shape. It's not a perfect movie. You know what I mean? Like when you say it's a feeling, that's what I call my ink blot. Like, I can feel it, I can see it, but kind of, you know, because it's not like I hear every line of dialogue and see every shot like a movie. Though it's kind of like this sort of ink blot movie in my mind, right? And I feel an attachment to it that I want to convey. Yeah.
So when you're getting notes from your parents, talk to me about that process. Was that something where you got the notes and it was devastating, or you got the notes and it was exciting, and the rewriting was exciting, and like where were you in that process? Was it all frustration, or was it like, oh, this is actually going to work, this is going to make it better, and I'm excited to do all these changes?
I think it was about 10% excitement and 90% frustration and anger, because my brain, the first draft, when I finished the first draft, my brain says, I'm done. I told mm-hmm. the story.
Yeah.
So to go back then is difficult. And when we were starting out, I did not trust my parents' editing as much as I should have. Because, well, I'm the one that's writing, and I'm the one that's read these books that have inspired me, and I've been thinking about this, and you know, I was a teenager, but I did take their marks and work them in. I mean, didn't ignore anything. It was just, it was hard. And, you know, it's a little bit of a blow to the ego when you put all that work in and time, and then someone comes along and says, you did it wrong, go fix it. But I couldn't deny it because I knew it wasn't working, or it wasn't as good as it could be. And so, of course, I did need to be fixed. The hardest part, actually, was that we did all that editing. And then once Random House picked up the book, I had to go through another round of editing with my then editor, Michelle, who is still my editor, actually. And that was really hard to then revisit a book that I'd had in the done category for a long time in my head. Yeah. So these days, I won't say that editing is my favorite thing to do, but I'm much more just concerned with the ultimate quality of the piece. So I will do whatever I have to, and that gives me great satisfaction. And I've learned a lot from revision. I've learned more from revising and editing than I ever have from strictly writing. So even though it's been a difficult process at times, I'm very grateful for it, and very grateful for all the wonderful editing I've received.
So there's two versions of this original book out there then. There's the self-published mm-hmm. version, and then it was Random House who picked it up and
yeah. There's my first draft, which has never seen the light of day
and
probably won't because Aragorn was,
right?
Aragorn was named Kevin in that draft. So
I love it.
Nice.
Wait, so Christopher, like when I'm editing, I have this, I tried to describe to my editor that it's like I've built this really elaborate house of cards where mm-hmm. I kind of see how everything connects. And so certain edits are so hard because it's like, wait, but the whole structure is going to collapse if I change this or change that. And I have to reimagine the structure of the house of cards, you know, so that I can then change a piece of it. And that part of it is so painful and often so rewarding. You know what I mean? Like you end up with a better house of cards, but man, sometimes you have to tear things down to build them back up, you know, and that part's a mix of frustrating and exciting, you know?
Yeah, I've had some substantial revision experiences, not so much with the Inheritance Cycle because I outlined the whole sucker from start to scratch, and that really helped me. But when I got into my sci-fi novel, To Sleep in a Sea of Stars, I got cocky.
Yeah.
It was like, hey, you know, I've written 4 books and they've all done extraordinarily well. Hey, I know what I'm doing and I've got a good idea and I've got a rough outline. I'm just going to go write this. And it turns out my brain can't do that. And so I wrote a very large novel of about 300,000 words that then had to be rewritten, and then finally I had to scrap 3/4 of it and write 3/4 of it from scratch with a solid outline finally. My agent
really
said,
you really did tear down the whole house of cards and rebuild
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Your
so,
agent
I mean,
said
my
what?
Agent, my agent said one of the nicest things ever to me, which was he thought I had, he thought I was just, you know, in the industry, he thought I was just really good at revision. And I was like, thank you, but I really would prefer not to have to need to do it. But, but yeah. You know, I to me, it's
well,
like
your
a
agent
magic.
Is your agent is Simon, right?
Yeah, Simon. So we have the same agent, for
yeah,
those
yeah,
who don't
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
But to me, it's kind of like a magic trick where, you know, the magician puts in a huge amount of work to do something in a non-intuitive manner. But for the people watching, you never see the insane amount of practice that goes in to make that appear effortless. And ultimately,
right.
when I adapted that mindset, then that helped me just sort of shrug and accept all of this as part of the process. And also, when I was younger, I had difficulty separating the ego from the work. So just because something in the work is not working doesn't mean you are a bad person or a bad writer. What will make you a bad
yeah.
writer is if you don't go fix it.
Isn't that so key to realize that this book is something separate from me that I am working on? It's not me, right? It's reflective of my judgment, which is where it maybe gets a little sensitive, But the work is something apart from you that you can work on with no risk to yourself if you see it that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Let it
and
be
yet,
clay on
you,
the table.
Don't you? But the difficult part with that, don't you find, is that you have to simultaneously hold that view and yet be extremely personal with the work at the same time. So you're sharing deep emotions and thoughts and ideas, and yet at the same time, it's like it's not me. It's separate from me.
Right. Like it's not me. And this represents everything that I think is cool and funny and interesting and worth reading and heroic and whatever. You know what I mean? It represents my judgment, right? It represents so much of my judgment on what's worth sharing. And that's the part that gets kind of painful, right? But like,
yeah. I mean, it sounds like it's almost like having a kid. The child is not you. But it is everything that you love and it's everything you care mm-hmm. for. And when you see that get torn down, it causes real pain. It's not like fake pain.
They're beating up my kid.
Uh-huh.
Well, and of course, now with the internet, we have the unique experience of being able to experience strangers making comments anonymously about your work where
right.
you're not technically present for those comments. But of course, you can go online and see those comments when they didn't, you know, wouldn't necessarily say that to your face. But we just, you know, we live in a strange time. So
I
Brandon,
generally stay away.
I try.
What were you
going to
say? Yeah.
So Brandon, I was going to ask, how much do you outline for your books and how much is it seat of your pants, you know, finding your own way as you're writing?
Yeah. Christopher, I'm almost like a perfect hybrid. I'm very much a hybrid. The outline is the ink blot in my mind. And that ink blot in my mind, I will spend sometimes years with that before I set pen to paper. And so like the thing that I trust in that movie in my head is that the cool stuff will stick and the boring stuff will fade away. And over time, it becomes an outline that I can feel. And then I start taking that ink blot cloud shaped story in my head and I create a specific scene. And then the rest of it morphs after that scene's made. And then I make another scene and another scene. And the ink blot keeps morphing. And so it's like, I couldn't do it without that mental plan. But I really like to do the math in my head on this because it keeps that ink blot really flexible for me. Mm. Right? Like if I'd written out the outline, then I'd be like almost like paint by numbers, like filling it in. And for me, it works better if I let it evolve as I write it, right? Like, so as I learn more about the characters by dramatizing them in scenes, everything kind of morphs. And so for whatever reason, the way my head works, that's what works for me. And like, I've done every single book more or less that way.
So you don't have a physical outline, something that you've written out. It's just...
The only physical outline I ever have is anything required by the publisher to sell the book, which usually isn't very much. Like sometimes they'll need a little bit and they'll ask for an outline and I'll give them 2 pages of like pretty general premise-y stuff. I'm like, this is kind of what it'll be. Just imagine me writing it.
When you outline, how long is your outline? I assume it's longer than 2 pages when you're outlining a story.
Well, it's funny because hearing you talk, Brandon, I just realized that I am currently working on a book with zero outline. Zero.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
I take that back. No, I did work out a general plan, but the current book I'm working on is another collection of short stories set in the world of Aragon. It's my second collection, but it's sort of come about in an unusual way because I wrote a chunk of 7 stories about 7 battles through the history of the land last year as part of a help cover some tariff costs for the company I'm working with on a collectible Sephira statue. And that's being published as the Book of Remembrance later this year. And then I'm taking that chunk and I'm adding a huge amount of surrounding material to turn it into an even larger collection for Random House. So it's been a really unusual writing experience in terms of constructing this. But as far as my larger novels go, I'd say the outlines tend to be 8 to 14 pages. And I'm with you, Brandon. I don't like to get so detailed that it feels like painting in the numbers, especially since when you write the actual scenes, the characters come alive and they'll do things you don't expect. Or
you make discoveries, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So what I'll usually do is like a paragraph per major scene and just tell myself, why are we here? What's the intro to the scene? Like, what's the problem the characters are trying to solve? What is the change that's going to occur? You know, what's the reversal? What's the upsetting of expectations? What's the new direction we're going to go into as a result of the problem the characters have experienced? What are they going to try next? And then, of course, you go to the next paragraph is, okay, well, they've tried something new, and of course, it can't immediately work or the book would be over. So how does this then change? How does this affect them? And this just drives me through to the end. Something, though, that I've since working on the Inheritance Cycle that I found very helpful is trying to understand what type of story I'm trying to tell. So is it a coming of age story? Is it a detective novel? Is it, you know, what is the story? And then every scene can kind of be pushing in that direction, whatever that direction is. And that helps me avoid a lot of the meandering and figuring out on the page that I was doing before.
I love the idea of having a plan. To me, I can't, because I know some writers are true improvisers, right? I mean, Stephen King famously says he pretty much just improvises his stuff. And like, to me, I can't imagine that. It's just too hard because I want some sense of destination. I want some sense of there's a place I'm going with this. But I think it's beautiful and cool that you can get there either way, you know?
Do you have the end of the story in your head when you start writing? Like, do you know what the final scene or culmination is going to be?
Look, I have a lot of it, But again, it's always a cloud shape. You know what I mean? So like how definitive is that ending? Nah, hard to say. Do I know kind of what I want the feeling to be? Kind of what I want it to, like, generally where I want people to end up? Yeah, I do. But that might morph a little bit as I tell the story.
You know it's interesting because for me, I usually have the exact scene. Maybe not the last, you know, the little coda at the end or something, but the actual big last scene or whatever. Because 9 times out of 10, that's why I'm writing the story. It's like, I want that. But sometimes it's reversed. Sometimes it's the opening that I want, and then everything else is to justify what the opening is. It's like there's something on either end usually that's like, this is why I'm interested in this story.
For me, there's always a few key moments that I desperately want to see happen, right?
Yeah.
Sort of like islands that I want the story to get to, like islands of cool moments like that, to be like, oh, that'd be awesome. And then like, oh, that'd be awesome. You know what I mean? Like, so it's like the rest of it, it's like, okay, so how can I tell a story where we hit some of these scenes that to me seem so worthwhile and so worth getting to, you know?
So I know you've had some pretty long ongoing series at this point. How many notes do you keep track of it these days? Like, do you have files with character names and place names and things like that? Or again, is it sort of, you know, in your head?
Yeah, look, when I'm working on a book, I will open up a file that's like let's say Guardians is the latest thing, right? And so let's say I've got Guardians Book 1, Forbidden Mountain, and I've got like my Guardians notes, just a file called Guardians notes. And that's where I put all the stuff that I'm worried I'm going to forget or that I think I need to remember. And then when I'm right, like I just finished the second Guardians book so that it can come out next year. And so I had Guardians 2 notes, and that had a lot of reminders of stuff from Book 1. And I just keep adding reminders as I need to remember stuff. And so it's almost like as I'm writing, I'm making like a little companion outline. You know, like, but the outline's mainly just like, don't forget this. Don't forget this guy's name. Don't forget this thing that has to pay off. Don't forget this cool place you wanted to include at some point. Like, it's stuff like that, right? Like, it's almost like just like a little caddy with lots of ideas that's there by my side that I can turn to when I feel like, oh, wait, what was that? Or like, what was that guy's name? Then I can look into the notes.
Gotcha. That sounds like a good system.
Yeah, how are you tracking? Are you doing something similar, or what are you doing?
I'm actually pretty rigorous with it because I got myself into trouble a few times early on. So I at the very least, what I'll do is have a Word file with different sections for names, places, and things at the minimum, and then usually a language section for any invented languages or phrases or things like that.
Yeah, keeping continuity on that stuff, right?
Yeah, because I mean, like with Inheritance Cycle, I forget how many named characters there were, but I think there were a couple hundred by the end, and a lot of them are just minor characters that get named here and there. But I was running into, like, you know, it's easy for me to like then repeat a name without realizing, which sometimes is fine, but I don't want to confuse readers, or I misremember a detail of like, oh, that character was left-handed, not right-handed, or something like that.
Yes, I hate it. Every now and then I did a thing in Fablehaven where an angry grandparent was like Seth Michael Sorensen. And then way later in the series, a couple books later, a different angry grandparent, Seth Andrew Sorensen. And it was like, so I try to tell when people pointed out, I'm like, no, grandparents, they just sometimes blow it. They forget, you know,
Seth Michael Andrew Sorensen. He's got two middle names.
It wasn't the author. It wasn't the stupid author that forgot he'd done that. And forgot that he
years ago I had my assistant build me a personalized wiki for my works.
Smart.
Which I, you know, we keep on a, you know, it's not open to the public, but I can just, then I can access it wherever I'm traveling or whatever, wherever I'm doing, and, you know, click through the name, and there's all the basic biographical detail. And then we update that for every book. And that's been, especially because I've been doing this for so long, you know, No, I don't really want to go back and reread Aragon at this point, although I've pretty much reread it this year for script work. But, you know, it's easy to forget. It's easy to forget. And you think, oh, I'll never forget this because I wrote it. But no, you can forget it.
You know, when you say you got in trouble,
did you have stuff that was published where there was continuity issues? Or
yeah, we've... we've had a lot of little changes in the books, continuity changes in the books over the years. You know, names that were spelled wrong, people that were left-handed when they were, should have been right-handed, or right-handed when they should have been left-handed, eye colors that changed, you know, and a lot of it's just the matter of me perhaps not checking something I should have when I was writing, or just misremembering. Like when I was working on Murtagh, which came out in 2023, you know, I'm writing about characters and events that I was working on when I was 15 back in 1998.
Right.
You know, you do your best.
And who's pointing this out to? I assume it's fans who come across.
Usually, I mean, if we don't catch it in the editing process, it's the readers. The best one was at the beginning of Murtagh. Hold on, I have a little argument, as I called it, at the beginning, just to introduce the world to everyone again and just set the stage. And I use this word, talking about the world. Throughout, one will find divers peoples and creatures, from hardy humans to et cetera, et cetera. So lots of people were saying, oh, there's a typo on the first page. It says divers when it should say diverse. And I was like, oh, come on. None of you read your Tolkien. None of you've read the King James Bible, or.
Yeah, you were doing like an old timey spelling kind of.
Yeah, I mean, you're fantasy fans. You should know the old words.
Yeah, that's funny. Oh, I love it.
I'll take the blame for that one. You know, you got to know your audience.
Hey, I got to ask you about this. How aware were you that Aragon was the word dragon with one letter, one tick off? Like, did you know that at first? Did it happen subconsciously?
How do you think I came up with it?
Was it just deliberate? Like, what was the thinking?
Yeah, of course it was deliberate. No, what happened was, because I was inspired by Jeremy Thatcher, Dragon Hatcher, which is set in the real world, I was wanting to write my sort of version of the story of a boy finding a dragon egg. So I took a stab at it without an outline. This was, again, before I knew about story structure.
Sure.
And I started with a boy in the real world named Kevin, who was on his family farm and goes out in the woods and ends up finding a dragon egg.
It was probably basically you.
Yeah, you know, he was 100% me.
Right?
You know what I mean? The easiest thing for a 15-year-old boy to write about is a 15-year-old boy.
Yeah, right.
So then when I tackled the story again with an outline, and I wrote this whole book, I didn't want to change the name Kevin, because I knew the name of the main character was so important, and I didn't want to waste time on something that was going to keep me from actually writing the book. So I just wrote the book and figured I can change the name later. And so after the fact, I was like, okay, now I have to replace Kevin. The problem is when you live with a name for a year and you're writing for a year, you get really, it's like your brain doesn't like any other version. So I wrote.
This guy's Kevin now. Yeah.
This guy's Kevin. So I wrote pages of names, of real historical names, just sort of invented fantasy names, just trying everything. And Aragon was one I threw out when I was doing it. I was like, change dragon, change the first letter to E. And I was like, no, that's just too obvious. No, just keep going. And it was only later when I was looking at the names and I was running through them with my mom to get another set of eyes and ears. I said, well, I kind of like Aragon, but it's, you know, it's just, it's really close to dragon. She's like, no, she said, that's a good one. You should try that. And that's how I ended up with Aragon. Now, what I did not realize at the time, because like so many nerdy homeschooled readers, I learned a lot of my vocabulary just by reading, and I never learned how to say a lot of the words that I was just reading on the page. So I did not realize that Aragorn was said Aragorn until we had Aragon printed and published, and I'm sitting in the theater watching Lord of the Rings, and they're saying Aragorn, Aragorn. I'm going, oh no, oh no. But at that point, I wasn't going to change it. And I will say that I think Aragon is easier for English speakers than Aragorn.
It absolutely is, and you have ruined Lord of the Rings for me. I always call him Aragon instead of Aragorn because of you. And to the point where as being a huge Lord of the Rings nerd, like I have to go, wait, is it Aragon or Aragorn? Which one is he? And yeah.
Well, ultimately the reason I use the name, what convinced, the reason I can, the way in which I convinced myself to use the name was that I liked the symbolic meaning of it is an era gone by. It is an era gone, because of course he's there for the passing of the old era. And that was like, that's why I want to use it.
Look, it's a name that totally works. For me, it took me years before I noticed, hey, that's Dragon. You know? But like, and when I did, to me, it was kind of an ad. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, well, that's kind of beautifully poetic that, you know, this.
Well, like, it tells like, you what's in the tin. It's exactly what's in the tin. Well, Brandon, Brandon, how do you go about getting your names? Because, I mean, you've had, you know, interesting mixes of both real world settings and names, but then you have a lot of fantastical stuff as well. So what's your approach on that?
Sure. Like in the real world, I'm often drawn from, like, my little sister's best friend was named Kendra when we were kids. My little brother's best friend was named Seth. I like that everyone isn't named Kendra, but some are. I like that everyone's not named Seth, but some are. It was like about the right amount of usage, you know, the right amount of frequency. For some of the real world names, I'm sometimes doing that, drawn from people I liked or people that I knew, or, you know, just like, I'll get a big fat name your baby book sometimes. And if I want a name that starts with B, then I got a lot of B names all in a row, right? You got that kind of thing there? Yep. No, hey, it's a simple way to do it. It's a smart way to do it, I think. But then also, when I'm doing my fantasy names, the thing I'm looking for is a name that's nice and different, but not too hard to pronounce, right? Mm. Looking for those two ideas. Like, to me, the perfect fantasy name is Gandalf, because it's not hard to spell, it's not hard to say, and you don't have a friend named Gandalf. You know what I mean? Not usually. You might have a cat, you know? I'm on the lookout for names like that. Like when I'm out doing book signings, like if I hear a name where I'm like, wait a minute, that one's not hard. It's easy to say, it's not hard to spell, and I don't ever hear it, I will write that down. You know what I mean? Like I'll keep a little log of it. And then I will go in search of those names, go onto the internet, say, give me Norwegian names, just names from other cultures. So they'll be a little different than what I hear every day. And I'll scan through looking for names that, okay, that's not too hard to say. It's pretty easy. Or like I can tweak it, you know what I mean, and make it easier to spell or easier to pronounce. But look, that's everything I got. That's my whole bag of tricks.
I was touring in Texas, and I can't remember if it was for Aragon or Eldest. Might have been for Eldest. And I had students come up, and I think they were from a school called Borromeo.
Whoa, and cool. Yeah.
I just loved the name. So in one of the books, I have Borromeo Castle, and it just it's got a great sound.
Yeah, you're right. That's part of the secret, is just stay on the lookout, right?
Well, I think we've got to wrap things up here. So, Christopher, thanks for being here with us today. Before we go, do you have anything coming up that we should know about that you want to plug for us?
Or anything recent or anything pluggable? Yeah.
Well, my two most recent books that published were Murtagh and Fractal Noise, which is a sci-fi novel, both of which were in 2023. The Book of Remembrance is coming out later this year, but the late pledges for that just closed today on the 15th of May. So I don't think anyone else can get that. So what'll be coming up next for me is Tales from Alagazia Volume 2, and then hopefully for some other stuff as well fairly soon that I can't talk about quite yet.
Awesome. And then what about you, Brandon? I know you just had a big release. Tell us a little bit about what's going on with you.
Yeah, so I mean, the latest thing is my Guardian series, Forbidden Mountain, is book one. It's for sure just three books. I'm so excited for people to share this one, because it's just some of my best work. It's about as good as I have in me, I think. And hopefully that'll be more obvious as you I know one and two now, because I've got one and two done, and just some of the payoffs I think will be really rewarding. But if you haven't checked that out, find Forbidden Mountain Guardians. It's for the kind of person who likes to read. Some of my books are for, you know, like maybe get a reluctant reader started. This one, I would say this is more for somebody who's some of my adult readers or my teen readers, or also like the kind of kid who loves to read a series or a thick book.
Awesome. Well, again, Christopher, thanks for being here. And thank you, everyone, for joining us on another episode of Mulling It Over with Brandon Mull.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.